says in the Gemara that the Amoraim sometimes to start off the shir with a joke to get people's interest. So I have a Nedarim related story for you, which is that on Erev Rosh Hashanah, so I was davening on the second floor of the YU Beis Medrash, which is usually much more sparsely populated during davening time. So at one point, during the main part of davening, so there were four people davening in the upstairs part, many people were davening in the downstairs part, but four people were davening in the upstairs part, two of whom were me and Rabbi Bleich.
J. David Bleich.
So I said...
In the neighborhood?
No, he lives in the Upper East Side. He comes here on certain occasions.
I know he lives in the Upper East.
Yeah. So I was thinking to myself, okay, perfect. We don't have to schlep downstairs. Not a long trip, obviously. But we don't have to go downstairs for Hataras Nedarim. We have four people right here, so we'll just take turns. Three people will be the bezdin, and one person will be the petitioner, and it'll be easy. So before the end of davening, two of the people left. So by the end, it was just me and Rabbi Bleich davening upstairs. So I said, right after davening was over, so we started walking approaching the stairs to walk downstairs to find bezdin for Hataras Nedarim. So as I turned to him, I said, Rebbe, it seems we've lost our bezdin here, but I think we still have a yachid mumcha, one individual who can mata the nedarim. So he just left. He didn't. It's a shaila. Again, we were discussing last time whether we have a yachid mumcha nowadays at all. There such a thing even exists. But according to the Rambam, yeah, he would be a yachid mumcha, because anyone who's an expert in the laws of nedarim would be a yachid mumcha.
After the tapes off, I'll tell you another story.
Din, oh, Mash Amru Sha'av Mefer Kol Neder. Again, continuing a mitzvah, Tavav 406, that the Torah has an institution. The only time where it says explicitly that a neder can be undone is what's called hafara, not hatara, the annulling of a neder rather than the revocation of a neder. So the father Shamar Sha'av Mefer Kol Neder V'Habal Nidre Inu Yudvarim Shebeinu Levena. So according to the Sefer Chinuch's understanding, which others disagree with, the father and the husband both have the same authority over the wife or daughter to annul her nedarim. That it applies only to nedarim that apply to their relationship, or that are nedarim that cause some affliction on the part of this woman. So if she takes a neder not to eat certain things, and the husband feels that would be too intense for her, and she get, it's not appropriate, then he's allowed to annul the neder. And according to many other sources, however, many other shittas, the father is actually allowed to annul any neder, and it's only the husband who has the restriction of that he can only annul nedarim that are inui nefesh or dvarim shebeino levena. So there's a difference also between the father and the husband, that the father has authority only over the girl until she turns 12 and a half. That's the general rule as well.
Oy.
That 12 and a half, so a girl becomes bas mitzvah at age 12, but there's another level which we barely even recognize nowadays, which is called the Bogeris. So between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half, she's called a Nairam, but after the age of 12 and a half, she's called the Bogeris. So once she's a Bogeris, her father has no authority over her anymore whatsoever. So he would only be allowed to annul her vows until the age of 12 and a half. And same thing is that we know there's a halacha that a father is allowed to marry his daughter off. So that only also applies until the age of 12 and a half. Once a girl turns 12 and a half and her father didn't marry her off, her father no longer has the authority to marry her off, and she can only get married to someone of her own free will. Between the ages of 12 and a half, Naira is like an intermediate period where both she and her father could marry her off. So until the age of 12 and a half, her father can annul her nedarim, but after the age of 12 and a half, no. But the husband has nothing to do with the age. The husband is only if she's a nesua. There are two stages of marriage, the erusin and the nisuin. So during the erusin, that's after the harayad mekudeshesli, and then the nisuin. Nowadays we do it both together, but in the olden days sometimes there'd be a long span between the erusin and the nisuin. The nisuin is when they actually move in together. So the husband can only nullify her nedarim when she is a nesua, not when she is an arusa. So you have an interesting concept that when she is an arusa, but she's still in the age where her father could annul her nedarim, So the father and the husband have to both do it together. That the only way she can have her nedarim annulled is when the both the father and the husband simultaneously agree that they would like to annul the nedar. Yeah.
Now, in either case, though, the woman could go to a beis din and get
sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Her own free will is on. You know.
Yeah, but this is even in a case, Hafara is even a case where she doesn't regret the nether at all, and there's no Pesach, right, and she says, but I want the nether. So the husband and father can say, too bad, you know, no nether for you, which in the long run might be better for her. But there's certainly she could have a regular Hataras Nedarim, that's no question. But this is a special institution where even with no reason whatsoever in the the conventional rules of Hataras Nedarim, the father or the husband can nullify her vows. It also applies, it says in the Torah, that it's only b'yom shomo, so it has to be on the day that the father or the husband hear about the neder. They only have that day period, not any 24 hours, but rather halachic day, nighttime and daytime, to nullify the neder.
You mean if she makes it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
When they hear about it, not when she makes it. B'yom shomo, yeah.
They have until... Sundown.
Wait, if we discussed, are we about to like exactly the mechanism by which the husband or the father, you know, nullifies it? Just make a declaration.
There's no mechanism. Mufralach. He hears the nether. She says, "Hey, honey, guess what? I vowed that I'm not gonna sleep on a mattress or something. So I only want to sleep on the floor." So he says, "Mufralach.
Oh, okay.
I don't want that. I don't want you to be uncomfortable and not get a good night's sleep. Mufralach." That's all it is. Just like a Bezdin would say Mutar Lach or Mutar Lich in Mishnaic Hebrew, technically. So then he would just say Mufar, and that would be it. But again, this is not something that's normally practiced now. Also because people don't make Nedarim in the same way as they used to. It's used to be seemingly a very common thing. Where does it say? V'din ha'omer kol neder she'edor kol shana zo mikan ad eser shanim harehen betalin. We discussed this concept that you could make a moda, that you could say any neder that I'm going to make in the next year or 10 years or whatever, I have in mind to cancel. That works. That declaration works. According to some, that's the pshat in kol nizri. That it's a future declaration. That's the way we normally say it nowadays. So when it was originally written, it was a retrospective declaration, not a prospective declaration. But that works, again, as long as you don't remember that you made this this declaration at the time that you make the vow. But if you remember that you made the declaration, you make the vow anyway, then your current vow will override the declaration that you made previously. V'din stam nedarim lahachmer u'perushan lahakel. That if you make a statement that could be interpreted either as a neder or not as a neder, so we go stringently and we interpret it that it was a neder. That's why people like to say bli neder. That makes it clear that the statement that that you make is not neder. Again, most of the time it's not going to be. There's no lashon neder at all, so it's not really a shaila. That's why people like to say bli neder all the time. But once you've determined that this thing is a neder and now you're trying to interpret it, it could be interpreted various ways. So you try to interpret it in the most lenient way possible. Again, when determining whether something is a nether or not, you go stringently. But once you determine that it is a nether, and you're trying to interpret the actual subject matter of the nether, then you go leniently. V'din she'ein adam oser davar she'eino shelo. That you can't make a nether regarding something that's not yours. You can make a nether regarding yourself, and you can make a nether regarding your objects. So you could forbid someone else's object to yourself, and you could forbid your object to someone else. And of course, you could forbid your own object to yourself. But you cannot forbid someone else's object to themselves. So if I make a nether that sefer is usher to the Gregor family, that doesn't work. It's nothing.
Nothing to do with
it has nothing. Because there's nothing. I have no power over this at all. But I could ask something of my own to someone else. As we discussed last time, we have the case that you see someone picking at your orchard, and you say, oh, neder, you are not allowed to benefit from my orchard, and then you realize that it was someone that you do want to benefit from, so you make Hataras Nedarim, yeah.
So, wait a second, if you do usher your possession to somebody else,
yeah,
that person has benefit from it, then is he over on...
Yeah.
Stealing?
He's over on my neder.
Yeah.
Are they stealing if they...
No.
Stealing is a different thing. So that's people. The reason you make so somebody pointed out last time. So what about somebody picking apples from your orchard without permission? That's stealing. So it's like, you know, so people in the olden days used to be very nervous about Nedarim, and they would be less nervous about stealing. That's like the joke, you know, that somebody finds, he goes to work every day, brings some milk for his coffee, finds every day he goes to his coffee, the milk is gone. So what's he going to do? So he writes on the milk, this is my milk, if you take it, you are stealing. Again, he finds the milk is gone. The next day he writes, if you take my milk, this is stealing. Remember, this is prohibited. Midaraisa, still the milk is gone. Remember, next day, it's in the Ten Commandments. Lo signo, whether it really means the Ten Commandments. The child, but, okay, whatever. But it says, it's in the Ten Commandments. You're violating one of the Ten Commandments if you take my milk. Again, the milk is gone. The next day, he writes on the milk, Cholov Nochri. And then the milk is there. Yeah. So you see, again, it's a very, hopefully such a thing wouldn't happen, but he said there's certain things that some people are more nervous about than others. So some people are more nervous about drinking Nachal of Yisrael than stealing. So here too, so people are more nervous about Nedarim. So that's why we'll discuss, I'll give you a preview of Yom Kippur. So maybe on the night of Yom Kippur, we'll discuss what the big deal is about Kol Nidre, why people are so concerned with Kol Nidre. Because emotionally, it was a mitzvah that they found very frightening, more than other mitzvos. V'din ha'omer l'chaveru kikri osur alecha o kikar zeh. So if you say, you have a loaf of bread, and you say, I forbid my loaf of bread to you. That's how you formulate the nether. I forbid my loaf of bread to you. Then the loaf of bread is only forbidden to the other person so long as it remains yours. But if you give the bread away or you sell the bread or it exits your possession somehow, then he's no longer bound by the vow and he can now derive benefit from the bread. But if you say, while you own it, kikar ze asur alecha, that this loaf of bread is asur to you, not my loaf of bread, but this loaf of bread, then it remains usher to the subject of the nether forever, no matter whose ownership it is, because you have power over it right now, because it belongs to you, so that power cannot be undone just because you sell it to someone else.
What's the difference between the first and the second thing you said?
You say, the question is whether you say my bread or this bread.
Yeah. Oh, so this bread is even if you sell it?
Right.
How the heck is anybody else supposed to know that?
He has to keep track.
What's the point of this?
I mean, if you quietly say to yourself, you know, you forbid all your possessions to Fred, so then if you never, no, Fred never finds out about it. So the point is, you have to tell him. That's not, yeah.
I think that once something leaves your possession, that the netter.
That's if you say my bread, but if you say this bread, while you own it, again, if someone else owns it, you can't do that.
But is it?
So in other words, wait. So it's like I would say, like a covenant on a house or something like that, saying that whoever else owns it still has to, you know.
Can't
sell
this.
Black.
Yeah, something like that. You know,
I guess so. Weird. I don't know. But while you own something, you have the power to determine its fate forever if you're so inclined. Yeah.
But, like, the thing is, if it's your bread, it's not the other guy's anyway. He's not allowed to take your bread.
It adds an additional level of prohibition. Or you're worried that you really don't want him to have the bread, and you're worried maybe that you'll feel bad and you'll give it to him.
And
why you do it is a different story. Why you do it is you have to talk to a therapist or something. But it's
v'din amudar hanam mechaveru
sheporeo lo eschovo. That if you're not allowed to, you have a nether that you can't give benefit to someone else. Nevertheless, you're allowed to reimburse a loan that he paid you. V'din hanoder min habasar shemutar barotev im amar basar ze asar af barotev. If you say that you're taking a nether not to eat meat, then you're allowed to eat gravy in which the meat was cooked. But if you say this particular piece of meat, then you're not even allowed to eat the gravy because the issue is not the gravy, but it's any juices, any derivatives of this particular piece of meat. V'din mishenesra anoso alav shemutar lamdo Torah shebal peh avalosh shebichsav lefishenotlin alas schar. That if somebody's benefit is prohibited to you, so he's allowed to teach you the oral Torah, but not the written Torah, because the din is technically that one is allowed to take money for the teaching of the Torah Shebichsav of Tanakh. One is not allowed to take money for the teaching of the oral Torah. So the reason that rabbis get paid nowadays, most of the, what they're teaching is the oral Torah, not exclusively, but most of the teaching of the Torah is what we call schar batola. That meaning the congregation wants a rabbi who's focused on them and doesn't want him to spend too much time being an investment banker or something. So they're offering him money in order that he shouldn't be an investment banker and instead he should be a rabbi. That's so it's basically.
So wait a second. So
I bet they don't pay you like
if an investment banker, you know, gives up this career to become a rabbi, then he should get paid a lot more than say, you know, a garbage man.
Well, he's willing to but it's not exactly tied into that. It's if he's willing to forego the
lifestyle.
If he's willing to forego that lifestyle, become a rabbi. So then that's not necessarily worth the same as actually being an investment banker. But this concept is at play for other areas of halacha as well. When you have dayonim on a case of a bezdin, so what they get is really supposed to be schar batola. And if it's really excessive, edim too. Like if you have edim on a get, so who's going to get two people to schlep down to spend a couple hours or whatever to sign gittin? So they have a right to be paid, but edim aren't really supposed to be paid. They're supposed to testify for free. So that's schar batola. But if the edim were getting if the Aiden were getting $1,000 an hour, that would be way more than Schar Batala. It has to be somewhat reasonable within the Schar Batala. And the idea is that nowadays we're on a lower level in terms of the teaching of the Torah. So the Rambam, for example, he could be a doctor, and he also had some investments with jewels. You know, his brother used to invest his money for him so that... So it got lost, and he had to be a doctor, whatever. So we had all these other sources of income, and there he could be a rabbi completely for free. But that's nowadays people don't have that kind of time that if you're a full time doctor, you can't spend enough time learning and teaching to be an effective rabbi. So that's why we're more lenient nowadays on this idea that you're supposed to pay someone that you're not really supposed to pay someone for teaching Torah. Yeah.
For example, if you pay somebody to lane. That's straightforward. You don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah. Right. Well, that problem would be Schar Shabbos. Schar Shabbos. If someone's laning on Shabbos.
That's the problem, yeah.
You're not allowed to pay someone for work done on Shabbos. Has to be included with work done before Shabbos. That's why you're really paying for the preparation and not just for the services on Shabbos. I heard a story, I think my grandmother told me, the Rabbi Riskin used to spend like an hour a week answering the phones in the shul.
Oh, I think that's true. Yeah.
So he said he shouldn't be paid exclusively for being a rabbi.
Right.
Rather, either paying him for answering the phones, they add on a little more.
That was also very smart because it kept him in touch with postcards.
There's a cute story someone told me about Rav Belsky that someone asked Rav Belsky a shayla, and he said, "That's usur. We're not allowed." So the person said, "No, Rabbi, can't you find some heter for me to do this?" So Rabelski said, "Okay, give me $50. So the guy said, "What? You only give me a heter if I pay you?" So Rabelski said, "That's ridiculous. I can't even pay any money for that." So Rabelski said, "What do you mean? I told you the answer to your shayla already. That's teaching Torah that I have to do for free. If you want me to tell you something that's not Torah, I'm allowed to charge for that." Fine. So you're allowed to, if you're not allowed to derive benefit from someone because of another, so then you're allowed to, they're allowed to teach you Torah Shebichsav, but not Torah Shebal Peh. I'm sorry, the opposite. They're allowed to teach you Torah Shebal Peh because that they would have to do for free anyway. But Torah Shebichsav, then they would not be allowed to teach you because they'd be entitled to ask for money for that. That's why, a rabbi can't say, if somebody asks a question, you're not in my congregation, I don't have to answer your question. Because fundamentally, the congregation is paying him just for being a rabbi. But for each individual piece of teaching Torah, if somebody asks you, you have to give an answer. You're not allowed to say, no, give me money for that. Yeah, I don't work here, basically, yeah. V'din masha amru b'nedarim alach achar l'shon b'nei adam b'oso makom v'oso loshem sheb'o v'oso zman. Shenadar Oshen Nishba. So the way you interpret Nedarim goes by the colloquial language. There's no official Torah rule for how a Nedar has to be formulated. I mean, there's some words, but it could go by whatever language and whatever the colloquialisms in that place are. V'din hafaras nedarim shukol hayom, that the hafara that a husband or a father can do is the whole day. Kilomar laila v'yom lo meis leis. That's what we said before. It's a halachic day, not 24 hours. Shnevar b'yom shamo. V'yasa rubei pratea yizbaru barucha b'maseches hamechuberes alzevi maseches nedarim. Obviously, it makes sense that this these subjects would be discussed in maseches nedarim. But noigas mitzvazo b'chol makom v'chol zman b'zucharim avalo b'nekevos. Because remember, we're talking now about the mitzvah to how to nullify nedarim. So either only men can do that, because whether it's the husband or a father of a woman who's doing the hafara, or whether it's a bezdin of three or a yochid mumcha, a one expert individual, so they'll have to be men. So the mitzvah, so a woman cannot annul a vow in any capacity. But of course, the laws governing nedarim apply equally to women and to men. Yeah.
What's the reason for this time limit on when the vow can be annulled?
The reason? I don't know, he doesn't discuss that in the Shor Shia Mitzvah. He's so busy with, he wants to go into the whole discussion of Hataras Adarim, he doesn't do a whole analysis of Hafaras Adarim.
After all, in order to sort of realize that, maybe a particular nether is going to be, injurious or something like that, you need a little bit of time to, to realize that. Stuff, right? You have to be like an immediate reaction,
Well, within that, you have a day to think about it. You don't have to be on the spot. The idea, if you want to give our own Shor Shia Mitzvah, so we have to, the point is that we have to treat Nedarim extremely seriously. If you have a lot of time, and you think about it, and you let it go, and a few days later, you realize maybe you didn't want it, point is, it has to be, it's a very serious thing, the idea of making a nether. So if you have too much flexibility in how you get rid of it, so then, again, this is what the Rambam holds, but the Ramban holds differently. That if you try to release the nether in a way that's not in consonance with the Torah, but it's done in heter, it doesn't work. The nether will still be in place. You neglected this positive commandment. As we said in the beginning of the mitzvah. Mitzvah Tav Zayin 407, Shelo nachel dvarenu b'nedarim, that we should not neglect to perform our nedarim. We should not profane our word, I think, is that. How did Har Scroll say? Profane?
What
is
that? Profane our words by disregarding.
Oh, profane our word. Baruch Shekivanti Har Scroll.
Okay.
So the, we're not allowed to do that. So we have to fulfill the nedarim. Shenimnanu shelo lishanos mashe nechayev benafshosenu bedibor, that we shouldn't change at all things that we orally declare ourselves to be obligated to do. Ve'avopi shehu belo shvua, even if there's no oath, but rather a neder, which again really goes on an object rather than on a person. Ve'ilem an adarim gion shiomar adam peros olam al peros medina plonis o min ploni o peros asur in olav. That you want a certain type of fruit or a certain area, fruit that comes from a certain area is going to be asur to you. Yeah.
One more good question. Take a neder, you have to actually out loud say, So if you write it down, which you normally consider to be more binding, if you write it written, that doesn't count.
That's interesting.
Not binding as a neder, but if you have a contract with someone, that's
the contract.
Uchmochen sheyomar ishto asura alav, that you're not allowed to have any benefit from your wife. V'chayotze be'elu ha'inyonim shechayev l'kayim alav. You got to do it. Again, bad, not a good idea, but okay. V'alzen ne'amar lo yachel dvaro. You should not profane your word. V'ferishet zichron v'bracha lo yased dvarav chulen. You shall not make your words profane, literally. Kilomar yachel chulen is the same shorish. Kilomar that you're going to say that you're obligated to do something or act in a certain way, and you don't do it. Things that you prohibit upon yourself, you violate the lo yachel dvaro. That even a nether that you make, not necessarily something that you prohibit upon yourself, but if you say you're going to donate an object to the Beis HaMikdash, or as a korban, or regular tzedakah, or to the shul, don't delay pledges to the shul. It's very important.
At one time, it used to be when somebody had an aliyah, at least in Europe, the way that it used to be announced was shenadar,
right,
using the terminology nadar, right. So that was something quite strict in its implication. I mean, a neder is something that you really are obligated to in a very, mm-hmm, very powerful way.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, the Yiddish word for, you know, when somebody gets something, schnuddering.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think that was modified because there were instances that people were just not able to. So in order not to be over that Avera, it was modified not to use that particular term, but to just elicit from the person who had an aliyah whether they wanted to contribute something without using that specific terminology of neder.
But even so, if you pledge something,
oh, yes,
to shul, you have to, that's considered a neder. You have to say bli neder.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because if you're in the context of pledging, so that's really, that really is considered a neder. So, so if you have, if you pledge the shul, and then it has to be, you have to give the money in a reasonable time frame, as immediate as possible. So here we have a small shul, so people get aliyahs a lot. So does it real? I don't know. So what's more? What makes more sense? People should give, a donation little after each time, or maybe you save up and then you send in a check after a few aliyahs. You send it for a larger amount of money.
Yeah. Excuse me, all of you, for having jumped in as soon as I walked in. I apologize.
Okay.
But you, at the right moment, you jumped in.
Aval binyanim acherim kigon hanoder lachaveru davar haomer davar ploni esa olo esa shelo bilashon neder v'iser v'konamos. That if you just pledge to do something without using a shvua or a neder or any of these types of terminologies, that's why, you know, you see people say all the time, you're going to do this, I promise to do this, yeah, I'll do this for you. It's not a good idea. If you always to be mechazik your words. You can say, yeah, I'll try to do this. That's the more refined way to speak. But if you say, if you're constantly using, I promise, I will, these types of lishonos, even if it's not really a neder, so then it's a bad idea. Yeah.
I mean, the trouble with this is that, you know, somebody says, listen, you know, this place is a mess, you got to clean it up. It says, all right, I'll clean it up today, bli neder. So take it seriously then.
Just because you say bli neder doesn't mean you shouldn't take it seriously.
No, well, I know, but if you say bli neder, it says, you know, of course I'm going to do it unless I don't feel like it, you know. I mean, it's not what it means.
Bli neder means you're trying to save yourself from violating the prohibition associated with the neder. It shouldn't be that you're taking it lightly.
You can have an intention to do whatever it is, and then the phone rings with three really urgent things, or something comes up.
Right, that's why you say bli neder.
Upstairs has some problem, and you have to help. Yeah. I mean, stuff could happen.
But you say constantly pledging to do stuff with seriously commitment terminology without is not correct in halacha.
Bad habit.
Eino, again, that means you shouldn't try to do it.
Which
sign? Tough sign. Eino over below yachel ella b'inyan shekosam. Nevertheless, you don't technically violate the prohibition of lo yachel unless it's a real nether. The omnom ala kol nemar b'torah. It's more generalized prohibition that the Rambam doesn't count as an explicit mitzvah for this regard. Midvar sheker tirchak. Thou shalt distance thyself from falsehood. So that's a generalized idea that we're not supposed to even to tell lies, or certainly not to make even quasi commitments that we're not intending to keep.
Is that so in the
Sefer Kinnah? No, I don't think so. No, yeah. The Ramban I think counts it as a mitzvah, but not the Rambam. So midvar sheker tirchak is a general thing that we know that you're only allowed to lie in certain instances. That in order to keep, you're allowed to tell white lies to keep the peace, like Aaron HaKohen did. Mm-hmm. And people used to have fights. So then he would say, you go to one person and say, you know, he really wants to make up with you. And then you go to the other person and say, you know, the other guy told me how much he wants to make up with you, but he's embarrassed to approach you. And so they would get together, each thinking that the other initiated the rapprochement.
Both finding out that Aaron HaKohen had lied.
Right. Like, okay, whatever. So they maybe they never find out that he lied.
Shalom
right. So that's white lies. We know that the Gemara talks about that if somebody asks you, there are different interpretations of Gemara, but a few things you're allowed to lie about, like if you know. If somebody asks you a shayla and said and you're allowed to say you don't know the answer, even if you really do, so it's not to display that you know.
But maybe they need to know the answer.
No, if it's, then you should answer the question. Then you should answer the question. But if somebody said, if it's not really, you know, necessary, or some people have reasons that they don't like the paskin. Like there are certain people who very big talmidei chachamim, enormous talmidei chachamim, and they spent all their time learning, you know, chidushei Reb Chaim Halevi, all the brisker Torah, which is good enough itself. But if that's what you spend all your time on, you don't have a mesorah for how to paskin halacha, or you're so nervous because you want to be choshish for all the shitos, briskers, whatever. So they don't want to answer other people's shilas. They do what they do halachically with all their chumras and whatever. But they don't want to answer other people's shilas because they don't have a derech and how to a straight, you know, normative type of psak. So that maybe they should. I'm not saying that's correct. That's not the Gemara says that that a Talmid Chacham is the highest level. Is Lasuki Shmaitza Liva Deilchasa. You're supposed to be able to apply your learning to life in a normative way. But I'd say okay. I'm just telling you the Maisa, certain experiences that I've had that certain very great Talmid Chacham that I've come into contact with are very hesitant to answer shilas because of this of these reasons.
Of course, Chaim Brister, he had in fact a posek.
Right. That's right. That's following exactly. That's following the example of Chaim Brister, who he was the Rav officially in Brisk, but there was also someone called the Dayan.
Yes.
Rav Simcha Zelig.
Who is the grandfather of Dr. Rieger.
Right, so he used to paskin the shilas, and Reb Chaim would take care of the orphans and the widows, and would give drushes, and he didn't really, he was, you know, made sure everything was running properly in the town, but he didn't really answer people's shilas. They say one time he got fed up with this. The people in the town got fed up with it. They said, yeah, everything is going to the die-in, but our Rav is not going to answer any questions. So he said, "Fine. So answer. I'll answer. Start answering some questions." So they there was apparently something that came up in Hilchos Nida. So the way they used to always be is that she would go to Reb Simcha Zelig's wife, and then to tell all the details of the question, and then they ask Reb Simcha Zelig. Reb Simcha Zelig would tell his wife, and his wife would tell it back to the lady. So they apparently, once Shaila came to that, somehow there was going to be this question asked, and Reb Chaim insisted on meeting with the woman and like grilling her on all the exact details of the question to make sure he answered properly. So that was the end of the of insisting that Reb Chaim.
Is this one of the reasons for the advent of the Yotzed Halacha?
No, the Yotze Halacha. The Yotze Halacha is not because the rabbis are unwilling to answer the shilas. The Yotze Halacha is because women are unwilling to ask the shilas. That's a totally different.
And the Rebbetzin supply is dwindling.
Why aren't the same? Approximately the same number of Rebbetzin as rabbis.
No, playing that role.
Rebbetzins, many Rebbetzins don't play that role anymore.
I mean, is Gitti always answering the phone to remember laying the details to you?
She could. There's no reason she can't.
No, I mean, she doesn't. Or it's not a major part of her life.
Right. I guess no. She has her own career. Right. Okay. So that's one thing. With Rosh Hashanah Tirchak is you could, if somebody says or if somebody asks, you know, says comes up to you randomly, says, "Hey, you know, have you learned all of Shas yet?" The guy really did, but he's embarrassed. He doesn't want to say, "Yes, I'm an expert at all of Shas." No, I still have more to learn. You're allowed to say something like that, yeah.
Because it seems about us, somebody was sort of pushed into writing an haskama for a book that really wasn't any good.
Uh-huh.
So he signed, you know, the haskama way at the bottom of the page. He says, you know, he's trying to follow the mitzvah, you know.
Keep
far from
us. So somebody we're actually discussing the other day. Somebody I was in a car coming back from a simcha, so there were a few people in the car were discussing, I think everyone else besides me was single, so they said they were discussing if someone's allowed to lie about their age for shiduchim purposes. So I think it's probably okay to either withhold that information or do something to slightly misrepresent it. Again, assuming that you're on that level. If you're 40 and you act like you're 80, so then you probably should, you know, you could tell them exactly. Okay, but whatever. But the if somebody's still young at heart, and okay, whatever. But I think if somebody asks directly, you know, how old is this person? I want an exact answer. I don't think that one is allowed to lie about that.
Why can't you just say, as Ann Landers?
Oh, you could withhold, say, yeah.
Why do you ask?
You could say that, yeah. But still, you could avoid answering the question.
I'm really not sure.
But I don't think. Well, you could maybe say I'm not sure.
Since you didn't answer the question, I know why I'm asking.
Right. So, I don't think that if somebody's really 42, you're allowed to say with confidence, she's 37.
But it's but are you talking about saying this to the shotgun or to the
whoever
potential spouse?
Potential spouse.
I think he owes him.
It's could be serious business. I heard that the Chazanish, in fact. That he never had, one reason he never had children is because somehow or other the age of his, Kala was misrepresented. They took 10 years off of her age.
That was yeah. That's
true.
That is true. Yeah.
She was past the age of childbearing?
No, she wasn't completely past, no, but she didn't. Yeah, she didn't.
He was such a tzaddik, he didn't,
He said he didn't want to embarrass her by nullifying, by breaking off the shidduch. She was really, I think when they got engaged, I think he was like, I think it was 26, 27, 28, something like that, and she was in her late 30s.
Oh, wow. Who the hell set that up? That's really bad.
It was a big problem. He was very not happy about it, and at a certain point that he saw that she really wasn't going to have children, then he said, they weren't happily married anyway, so he said he wants to get divorced. So she said that she's fine. She'll accept it, no problem. But on the way home from the Besdin, she's going to jump off the bridge. So she threatened to commit suicide. So he didn't want her to commit suicide. So he did. So he never got divorced, and he never had children. It's a very sad story. The marriage of the husband.
I think
the
shotgun is
going
to have to answer some big questions.
Probably yes, but anyway, it was a big issue. The Haramban Zal Kosav Shishtei Mitzvos Chalukos Hein Nidre Gavoav and Nidre Bitui. That there too, this mitzvah is divided into two things. One is Nidre Gavoav, which is pledges to Tzedakah or for the Beis Hamikdash, and Nidre Bitui, or stuff that you forbid on yourself. So this the two separate mitzvahs. Moshe Nichtov Lemata Beseder Kiseitze Asay Tezvav Besimen Tafkuf Memvav, and we'll get there. Rav Hashem in Parshas Kiseitze, well, he discusses it very much at length. Shorish Hamitzvah Binyan Hanedarim Bashuas Lekayim Kol Davar Kasavti Kvar Beseder Vayishma Yisrael Osase Hey. That this is all discussed way back in the Ten Commandments. We're talking about not taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Midinei Hamitzvah, Masha Amar Zichrono Livracha, Hu Eino Mechal Valachirim Mochalin Lo. That's part of the allusions that we find in the Chumash for the concept of Hataras Adarim, that it says Lo Yachel Dvaro, that the person who makes the vow should not profane his word, but that means the person himself. But if he goes to other people to ask for profanation, they can be matter his vow. Like there's a bezdin of three or an expert individual. That you could ask for hatara if you pledge something to tzedakah, to the Beis HaMikdash, as long as it hasn't gotten into the hands yet of the collection agent. So the gabai means in classical halakhic terminology.
If somebody promises to donate an object to the Beis HaMikdash, what kind of objects were donated?
You would donate an object, and then the temple treasury would sell it, and then we'll use the money. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or if you donate a medal, so if they need to build a new klisharis or something, you could use the medal directly. V'afilu al hatruma v'alachala amar zichron al-levracha sh'nish'alin aleihen ad shelo bo liyad kohen. That you can also undo your separation of truma sumaisris, of the tithes, and hafrashas chala. I actually one time in Yerushalayim, I was approached by a fellow. I was walking, I guess he managed to collect three people. I was walking with another prachavis, I don't remember exactly, but collected three people. It was actually on a Shabbos. And normally you're not supposed to be matar or neder on Shabbos, but here there was, because it was needed for Shabbos, so we were allowed. So he said that his wife baked chala yesterday, and she was mafresh chala, and the chala, I mean the separated part, fell into the cholent. It was right before Shabbos lunchtime. So he says, that's not kosher. So he gathered a Beis Din on Shabbos, and he said, I want to be Matir Neder. I want the challah that you separate from the dough. It's supposed to be given to a Kohen, theoretically. It's not allowed for regular Jews to eat this. And for Kohanim, they also have to be Tahar or whatever in order to eat it.
So it's not kosher because?
Because the challah fell into the cholent.
What made that not kosher?
Because you have down
the challah is not kosher.
Yeah.
I can't eat it. No, they can't. Who can't eat it?
Why? No.
Regular Jews. Only Kohanim who are Tahar can eat
the... Which means no Jews then.
Why couldn't they give it to the Kohen?
This is challah Eretz Yisrael, so it's more stringent.
Why couldn't they give it to the Kohen?
But they didn't. You could give it to a Kohen. The Kohen can't eat it under most.
Why?
Because Chalas Eretz Yisrael. It has both the. It's Chala that was that. This case happened to be Chalas Eretz Yisrael that was from Israel. So both the Chala and the Kohen have to be Tahar.
So what is falling into the Chalat have to do with this?
So it made the Chalat not kosher.
What do you mean it made it?
You peppery Chala, harizo Chala. Now you have this little batch of piece of dough that's not kosher.
The problem is with the Chalat.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't
even show it. Yeah. So the main question. So he made Hataris and Darim on Shabbos. So we undid his. There's no bigger charata than this. If you had known that it would fall into the cholent, obviously it wouldn't have been mafresh. So we undid his hafresh as chala, and then he took chala separately from the from the chala.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh. I'm using the same word for two different meanings.
It wouldn't seem very Shabbistic, but okay.
Oh, you need it for Shabbos, otherwise wouldn't be able to eat your challenge.
I don't understand.
So what? They were allowed to eat food.
Right, so we undid his hafreshes challah. Right.
On Shabbos, you undid.
Right.
So that whatever fell in is not...
It's no longer challah.
Correct, now no longer challah. Then you separate the challah from a different part of the what she baked.
Okay.
Which you can do on Shabbos.
Under certain circumstances. Presumably they had a mechanism to do it on Shabbos. I mean, there's what's called Tanai, that if you make a declaration before Shabbos they're going to be Mafresh Challah, then you're allowed to do it. Normally you're not supposed to be Mafresh Challah or Chumas Umaisers on Shabbos. If we're Chalas Chutz La'aretz, it would be much easier, because then Chalas Chutz La'aretz, you're allowed to eat the bread and then be Mafresh Challah afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But in Chalas Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to do that, so it wouldn't
Women
have been.
Usually do. Take it before.
Yeah, it's easier. Just get it over with.
Right.
You know, you have all everything in front of you. You take it before you do the mitzvah, and done.
Yeah, or you discover that the people haven't taken it as you're sitting at the table, kind of thing.
Right. Exactly.
Case we discussed.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then you just leave a little bit of bread over till after Shabbos, and you separate the challah afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It's all explained in Maseches Nedarim. It applies to males and females at all places and times. Over alzev nadar o asar isar al nafsho belo shvua belo kiemo avar al lavze. So if you don't fulfill your nether, you violated this commandment. Aval eino loke alav lefi she'ein bo ma'isa. This is a lav she'ein bo ma'isa, because you're just doing something that's not a direct action. It's passively refraining from fulfilling your nether. V'zeu she'amru zichanu levracha she'anishba ve'ameimar mekal chaviru b'ashem loke afal pi she'ein sham ma'isa. It's a nishba, that if somebody takes a false vow or does temura, switches out one korban for some of the animal they designated the korban for another one, and if you curse someone with the name of God, then you do receive the penalty of lashes, even though that's only an oral declaration. Normally, you don't receive lashes for something that's just speech.
Hmm.
But here, the nishba, this only applies to someone who takes a vow with the name of God. About mishum lav deliachal benedero iser shelo b'shvua ein b'malkus. But just for not performing a nether which does not require the name of God, then this would be not a viol. This would for the shvua would not be a violation of Lo Yachel Devaro, and if you did the violation of Lo Yachel Devaro, you would not receive the penalty of Malkus of Lashes. I think we'll leave the next Parsha for next time, which will be Mitz Hashem, the Sunday after Sukkot. Three weeks.
Thank you. I apologize for coming in late.
Oh, that's okay.
I have nothing.
And thank you very much.